this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
You know, they say follow the science. Well, let's face it, the science isn't there. Listen to us. We're sick, and we need out of these homes until they can at least be tested and we can be shown that it's safe to go back into them.
East Palestine residents report on the recent storm that brought massive amounts of toxic vinyl chloride to the surface and further dangers to the community.
The case before us involves momentous events affecting the life and well-being of hundreds of thousands of people, and even the destruction of an entire people.
Nicaragua takes Germany to the ICJ for providing arms to Israel in its genocide of the Palestinian people. We hear from Nicaragua's chief counsel, Ambassador Carlos Arguello Gomez.
Well, our union, unfortunately, is infiltrated. Our employer, CTA, owns our union. Management and union collaborate to get members fired, to get members disciplined.
Chicago bus drivers fight for democracy in their union.
These were more like thugs rather than police officers. They took Jorge Glass against his will, and he was kidnapped and is now against his will with arbitrary detention in the Ecuadorian prison.
Mexico has cut all diplomatic ties with Ecuador after Ecuadorian police officers forcibly raided the Mexican embassy in Quito and detained former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Last week, there were major storms on the East Coast. In East Palestine, Ohio, there was massive flooding, and the toxins released in the Norfolk Southern train derailment, such as vinyl chloride, were coming to the surface. The residents are still getting sick and are unable to move out because of President Biden's refusal to institute the Stafford Act, which would provide health care and compensation to residents who want to sell their devalued homes and leave town. They say that Norfolk Southern is being allowed to run the town, while the Environmental Protection Agency is missing in action. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewed residents Jamie Ray Wallace of the Unity Council and Laborers International Union of North America Local 1039 member Chris Albright.
Recently, this $600 million settlement, this class action settlement, what is that all about? And is that going to help the people of East Palestine and really deal with the issues that you face?
No, it's not. It's going to help out the lawyers. It's basically, I mean, just from listening to a lot of the buzz around town and in the different groups and everything, it's a slap in the face is what it is.
And Jamie, what's your thoughts on that settlement?
You know, I'm just real curious as to why they want to settle now. We don't even have the final ruling from the NTSB hearings. Our creeks are still heavily contaminated. We still have people being exposed. You know, I think if they figured out, like if they divided everything equally, residents would get $6,000 a piece. But what you have to remember is, number one, there are 31 businesses that are in this lawsuit. So they're going to get a higher percentage of the property loss money. They've also extended it out to 20 miles and it's still open for people to sign up with right now. So we don't even know what the final number of people are going to be. I mean, I would imagine people 20 miles out that didn't think they had a lawsuit, whether they had symptoms or property loss or anything else, they'll now be getting a check for nuisance. So how many people do you think are going to sign up for that? So again, I feel like exactly what you said, Chris, it's going to be the lawyers that benefit. I mean, what benefit is it to them to go to trial and spend all that money and all that time to get us, the residents, more money? They'll be millionaires and we'll end up with not even enough money to test our homes. We'll be in the exact same situation we're in now with a couple thousand dollars in the bank.
And workers such as yourself at the conference that was held in East Palestine, residents testified about their serious health problems going into bankruptcy. One nurse from the Ohio Nurses Association said she was in debt $500,000. The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, is supposed to be responsible for oversight of health and safety. What has happened in East Palestine? Have they done a survey of any of the residents to find out what the health effects are of the vinyl chloride?
Absolutely not. They actually released a notice the other day, last week, I think it was, saying that they did not declare East Palestine a natural disaster area or a health crisis because there weren't enough documented cases. How do you know there's not enough documented cases when you're not going out and you're not checking with the people who live in this town? You don't know. You've never come. You came to my door one time and it was after I had an article in the New York Times. You've never asked me about my health, my family's health, my neighbor's health, anything like that. You don't know jack to make that determination.
Just to take that one step farther, when you see all the information that's released from even President Biden, his latest executive order, in it, it will say, under the Biden administration, we ordered EPA, FEMA, and CDC to go door to door in East Palestine. You may have ordered it, but CDC went door to door one day. Half of their workers got sick, which is the same, I would say, reporting symptoms in East Palestine, about half the people. They reported the same symptoms that people were reporting. They also reported that when they left town, the illness went away, like it did for residents. They went one day and got sick and never came back. To this day, not only has no one gone door to door, but a group of volunteers, a bunch of us were going door to door early on, asking if people needed air purifiers, air filter, independent testing, water. The local police department stopped us. They said that we fell under an ordinance for vendors and peddlers, and that if we wanted to continue to go door to door, that we would have to fill out an application with the village and pay a $400 permit fee. We took it to the ACLU, who said it was unconstitutional. So the city agreed to repeal that part of the ordinance without litigation, but no one could go door to door from the end of last April through August 24th. So not only is our government not doing it, our local government, the mayor, when asked why he didn't go door to door, he said, well, I have a wife and two kids in sports. I have a kid. Do you know how much time I gave up with my kid to go door to door? You know, I just, when they were approving the park plan, I was getting out of the car at my brother's and had some woman screaming at me from across the street. We need help. We need help. I go over. She lives there with her 83-year-old mother. They have no technology. They have no transportation, very little money. They had no clue what was going on or how to get themselves out. And the mother had almost died twice. So no one has asked the people or going door to door. There are no surveys. Our local government has not. They can't tell you how many people have moved and how many people have not. How many people are sick? How many people are not? No one is keeping these statistics.
And Chris, you had said this morning there's a lot of construction going on. There have been flooding in East Palestine. The water is coming up, it's chemicals in the water. It seems the government, the U.S. government, the EPA, have put Norfolk Southern in charge of the town. Norfolk Southern built a park, $25 million, when people need health care. I mean, what is going on? I mean, Norfolk Southern, it seems like, are bribing people, pitting people against each other in the town. Is that what's happening in East Palestine at this point?
Absolutely, absolutely. Right now, you know, Norfolk Southern, they're holding all the cards. They're in charge of everything, no matter who wants to deny it or not. That's what's going on. Norfolk Southern is running everything right now. They're running our government. They're running our police. They're running all our businesses right now today, because of all the rain and everything. They're down there. They're going nuts. There are trucks upon trucks upon trucks down there, right, where there never really is. They're digging up across the street where by the creeks. They're pumping water. They're doing all kinds of stuff now. And it's all Norfolk Southern. Norfolk Southern is governing Norfolk Southern. They're like the cleanups and everything. Nobody's watching them except for Norfolk Southern. How does that work? That makes no sense.
Perfect example of that, Chris, is when Norfolk Southern finally came up with their cleanup plan for the creeks. They started cleaning it up and chemicals were openly flowing down our creeks again. Where was the EPA oversight? Like Chris is saying, these were Norfolk Southern contractors. The EPA wasn't there to see it. And where the hell are these people's common sense? You know you're there to clean up chemicals. If Chris or I were working those pumps and we see the chemicals free flowing, wouldn't you say, Chris, wait a minute, this probably isn't right. I'm here to clean this stuff up and I'm flowing it. Like, it's ridiculous. And the fact of the matter is, They have no clue what they're doing. Just say that. They keep telling us we're fine because they're testing single chemical exposure limits. So when they get these limits of vinyl chloride that you can be in at safe levels, they only expose that subject to vinyl chloride. There's zero research on what happens if you expose people to 50, 60, 100 different chemicals all at once, even if they're at below those reportable levels. So the fact of the matter is they don't know. The science is not there. There's a research gap. So when do you start listening to the people that have symptoms? When do you start listening to the people's bodies? You know, they say follow the science. Well, let's face it. The science isn't there. Listen to us. We're sick. And we need out of these homes until they can at least be tested and we can be shown that it's safe to go back into them.
Now, when President Biden came to East Palestine, people had hoped that he would institute the Stafford Act, which is a law particularly for these kind of circumstances where there's a mass toxic incident and people need health care. And they also need compensation so they can move out, so they're not forced to live in a community that's contaminated and is continuing to be contaminated. He didn't institute the Stafford Act. He gave some money for research grants, maybe to find out what's going to happen 20 years from now to people, but people are suffering now. Do you think that there's really a conspiracy, a criminal conspiracy between the government and Norfolk Southern to limit their liabilities, to force people to live in a community that's toxic? And people are getting sick? I mean, it sounds like a criminal enterprise to force people to live in those circumstances. Who would want to live in poisoned community with poisons coming out? I mean, I doubt the CEOs and their families would spend 10 minutes in East Palestine.
Well, I'd gladly give them my house and let any of them stay here. I got no problem with that. Come on in. My door's open. I will welcome you here with open arms. We'll drink all the tap water you want and bathe in the water, do all that stuff. You know, we'll plant a garden too. You know, you can eat the vegetables out of that too. I dare you. You know, as far as it being criminal and everything, I'm not a fan of Norfolk Southern, obviously, because of everything that happened. But I also know we need the railroads. We need safety acts on the railroads. But as far as the government goes, like, the railroad workers tried to strike, and the government said, no, you can't do that. We're not going to let you strike. They're running the show. It's ridiculous. Again, it makes no sense. I mean, you got people getting sick and people dying. And I've said this 1 million times, nothing has changed, and this can happen at any time, anywhere. If you live near train tracks, this can happen. It'll happen to you. It happened here. It's going to continue to happen because nothing has changed. And our government isn't doing anything to change it.
And it's an emergency situation. There's still train wrecks going on even after this train wreck. And I mean, there are no train wrecks in Europe. There are no train wrecks in Japan, Korea, in China, but they're train wrecks in the United States. How do you figure that?
A different view of the criminalness of it. If I poisoned my husband for his life insurance, I would be in prison, one person, right? They poison 4,700 people at least for money and nothing's happening. Yes, we do need the railroad. There's no doubt. I agree with you, Chris, but we need a railroad that's not corrupt, one that's not willing to kill people as a cost of doing business, and one that has these safety regulations. You know, again, when the workers themselves are saying this is not safe, and we tell them they can't strike and we don't listen to the workers, why? Why? Do you think it's all those politicians' pockets that are lined with the money of Norfolk Southern and the railroad? Well, yeah. And right now, I mean, people, our city government is being openly paid off. I don't care who you are. There's no way you can deny it. Like Chris said, we live in the village of Norfolk Southern now. That's who's truly in charge.
And you're doing a campaign to get President Biden to institute the Stafford Act, which would allow you to get health care, which would allow you to get compensation to move out if you feel you have to defend yourself and your family, protect them. And you're trying to get unions and Liz Schuler, the president of the AFL-CIO, to support this call. What can people do in unions and workers in this country to make sure that you get the Stafford Act so you can get health care and compensation to move out so you're not stuck in a poisonous community?
First of all, unite. You know, there's definitely power in numbers. We had that event that you spoke about, and We had a lot of different unions there, a lot of different people there, and just getting everybody in one place and talking about the same thing. And they're going to go on and they're going to talk to their brothers and sisters, and they're going to talk about it. And the more we keep talking about it, the more that's going to happen. The more pressure we're going to put on the government, on all the different agencies that are supposed to be helping us and taking care of us. You know, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Protection. It's in their name, yet they're not protecting us.
Those were East Palestine residents Jamie Ray Wallace and Chris Albright speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. That was Mike Stout. We are the working class. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Last week, Nicaragua's attorneys argued their International Court of Justice case against Germany for supplying Israel with arms used to commit genocide. Pacifica's Don DeBar spoke to Carlos Arguello Gomez, Nicaragua's ambassador to the Netherlands and lead counsel for Nicaragua at the ICJ.
Well, the case was brought against Germany for its assistance in abetting what is happening in Palestine, what Israel is doing in Palestine. As everybody knows, there is a case already against Israel that was brought by South Africa. Those are for the crimes directly committed by Israel. The crimes claimed by South Africa are only based on the Genocide Convention, because that is the only basis of jurisdiction against Israel, because Israel doesn't recognize the jurisdiction on any other convention. So the only crime that they can be accused of is the crime of genocide. Now, faced with that situation, and to speak, let's say, on a personal level, for me it was quite impressive after the case was brought by South Africa, and in the first days of January of this year, of course, immediately, the first country to react was Germany and say, we are going to intervene in the case in favor of Israel. And then you had interviews with law professors, with very important people. And the impression was, well, you know, the genocide is very difficult to prove. So the impression in the public listening to all that was, well, there's doubt if Israel is doing something wrong. There's no doubt, absolutely no doubt. Israel is committing all the crimes in humanity in the international humanitarian law. The only reason is that South Africa or no country can go against Israel only on the basis of Genocide Convention. So after hearing that, Nicaragua wanted to assist as much as possible for the Palestinian people. And we have experience in the court. I mean, we are not discovering the International Court of Justice. We had a case against the United States 40 years ago, which changed, including the history of the court itself. The court has changed. It has become used by many countries after the Nicaragua case. We have had more cases than practically most countries in the world, with the exception perhaps of the United States. We've had 15 cases in my time in the court, I mean, just about as much as France and the UK, and a little bit less than the United States. So it's not that we are discovering the court and doing something special. We know the court. It's one of the things we know about it, our litigation in the court, is one of the things in which we could help the Palestinian people. So where could a helper reside? According to the conventions, including the Genocide Convention, but also the international humanitarian laws, the Conventions of Geneva of 1949, and its protocols, and all customary international law relating to the peremptory norms, those legal norms that cannot be avoided or contradicted or go against all principles of humanity, like slavery, like apartheid, like genocide. All those are precisely norms of peremptory international law. And we have absolutely open jurisdiction, total jurisdiction against several countries that accept jurisdiction of the court on all bases. One of them is Germany. Obviously, the principal supplier and abettor of what is happening in Israel is the United States. But we don't have any jurisdiction against the United States to bring it to the international court. The United States was very careful because the United States was one of the last to become a party to the Genocide Convention. The Genocide Convention is from 1948. The United States became a party in 1988, 40 years later, and with a lot of reservations that make it impossible to bring it to the court or do anything. So is that possible, not feasible, to bring the United States to the court? So the next possibility was the second principal supplier of weapons to Israel, which is Germany. And why do we go against Germany? Because all these conventions have the obligation of prevention. The Genocide Convention, for example, says that all countries have the obligation to prevent and punish genocide. If you have the obligation to prevent, it doesn't mean that a genocide has already to have been completed and that a court of justice has to say, well, a genocide has already been done, and period. No, you have an obligation to prevent it. And when does that obligation arise? The only logical way is it arises when you are aware of what is happening. And Germany, as we told it in court very clearly in our application, Germany has been aware of this from the first few days that this started. The Secretary General of the United Nations said it on the 9th of October. The President of the Red Cross, all the authorities, we presented a document of hundreds and thousands of people who have been saying this, authorities saying that genocide, international humanitarian law, is being violated. So Germany had the obligation to stop selling weapons and stop abetting Israel. So that is why we are claiming it against Germany. Not because Germany directly is killing the people or massacring the people in Palestine, but the bullets that they are supplying, the tanks and the airplanes that they are preparing are the ones that I'm killing. So that is, let's say, the background to the case we have in the court. The importance of this case, unfortunately, it's difficult to even say, I can't even find the words to say it appropriately, but because there's nothing that goes beyond the horror that's happening there. But the importance of this case also goes beyond the present circumstances. It is that there's an obligation, international obligation, the international community has the obligation to help prevent these horrors. It's happening in Palestine now, it has happened in the past, in the recent past, in other areas in the world. And things are not done. Countries have an obligation to do something. So that's why this case is very important, not only because of the immediate effect we hope it will have, because if the court accepts Nicaragua's request and orders Germany to stop aiding and abetting Israel, then this will be a message to the international community, a very clear message. And hopefully, the result will be something like what happened in South Africa, when finally the world was convinced that the only way to finish with the apartheid regime and the horrors that were happening in South Africa was to stop aiding and abetting the white apartheid regime there. Well, that simply fell off. That simply fell down and finished. So our hope also, if countries stop aiding and abetting Israel, the same thing will happen, and a solution will finally come to that very sad part of the world. That, let's say, is a summary of our position.
You've had the opportunity to see the court operate for a very long time. Back in January, when they issued their opinion regarding the case brought by South Africa, one of the pieces of relief that South Africa sought was to have Israel stop interfering with the delivery of aid. And in fact, the court, after finding, by the way, that there was a probability that genocide had occurred, directed Israel to not interfere and to affirmatively enable the delivery of aid. And that was one day before Germany and the United States cut off funding to the principal agent of aid, UNRWA. How do you think the court is going to treat what looks like an insult, basically, to its order?
Well, hopefully they'll really act upon it. And frankly, this gives them the opportunity of doing it with the case with Germany, because before Germany was not before the court, it was only South Africa against Israel. But the point you're mentioning is, frankly, something that was very shocking. And I emphasized it in my presentation and the day we spoke. And I made the comparison, which is obvious when you think about it. You have, apart from the cynicism of making this accusation one day after the court gave the order, which, of course, as you pointed out, is absolutely incredible. I mean, it's just a school making fun of the court. But from the point of view of the other countries, of Germany, of the United States, of all the other countries, they acted on the sole statement of Israel, saying that certain six or a dozen persons from this organization supposedly had participated in the events of 7 October that began the attacks on that going on in effect. Now, this to this day has not been proven, apart from the fact that even 12 individuals out of 12,000 or 15,000, I don't know how many, but it's more than 12,000 workers and staff people in UNRWA working in that area. We're talking about a ridiculous amount. We're not going to end, even if it was entirely proven, wasn't proven, it was just the word of Israel. And at that moment, as you mentioned, immediately they suspended the aid. So one of the questions I asked them in the court is, and the sole say-so of Israel, you suspended the aid. But you have been listening from the Secretary General of the United Nations to everybody, that a genocide is going on, and you haven't stopped the aid to Israel. So, I mean, how cynical can you get? I mean, what are you talking about? That you are imposing sanctions? That's a problem with the sanctions also. I mean, the sanctions are simply a political decision. They try to say we are based on international law, we are defending international law. No, they are political decisions. Like this, it's incredible. I mean, it's so evident. It's incredible.
That was Carlos Arguello Gomez, Nicaragua's ambassador to the Netherlands and permanent representative of Nicaragua at the International Court of Justice. He was speaking to Pacifica's Don DeBar. Music by Los Rústicos del Norte, Soberanía. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Mexico cut all diplomatic ties with Ecuador after Ecuadorian police officers forcibly raided the Mexican embassy in Quito and detained former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass. Glass had been granted political asylum by Mexico earlier that day amid intensified political persecution against him. Andrés Arauz, former Ecuadorian presidential candidate and a research fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, spoke to Breakthrough News hosts Eugene Perrier and Rania Kalik about the brazen violation of Mexican sovereignty and the ongoing political persecution that Latin America's leftist governments and the former officials of those governments face.
First, it wasn't an arrest because once the police agents cross the border and enter the Mexican embassy, it becomes an act of kidnapping, right? Because they don't have any legal authority to act on Mexican soil or Mexican jurisdiction. So one of the things that we're actually working on is a kidnapping case, a criminal case in Mexican courts to find Daniel Noboa, the president of Ecuador, responsible for kidnapping Glass from another country, from exerting unilateral and arbitrary force outside of Ecuador's jurisdiction. So that's an important concept that we have to deal with here. And Jorge Glass is important to mention his case. In the Americas, we have this system of human rights called the Inter-American Court of Human Rights and the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights. And since 2019, up to now, Jorge Glass has already received what are called provisional measures defending Jorge Glass from political persecution. So he has already been recognized as a political prisoner, as someone who has been persecuted politically ever since 2019. And now, when he in December of last year, when he entered the Mexican embassy, he was a free man. Sure, there were some pending cases in the judicial system and the courts, but he was a free man when he entered the Mexican embassy, but he was still being persecuted by Ecuador's attorney general, completely aligned with the most conservative forces in the United States and with the extreme and ultra-right-wing forces of Ecuador. In December, when he entered the Mexican embassy, they wanted to arrest him, even though they didn't have an arrest warrant or a judicial order authorizing them to do so. So when he entered the Mexican embassy and when he requested political asylum, he was a free man. He did not have any arrest warrants or anything pending. However, after he entered the embassy, as has been happening in Ecuador for the last few years, the courts were stacked. They changed the justice system. They changed the administrative council of the justice system. They changed the National Supreme Court. And of course, in express decisions, they found Jorge Glass guilty and then justified the incursion, the invasion of Ecuadorian forces that removed their badges, that removed their name tags in order to enter the Mexican embassy. So these were more like thugs rather than police officers. They took Jorge Glass against his will, and he was kidnapped and is now in against his will and with arbitrary detention in the Ecuadorian prison.
You know, Andres, I'm curious a couple things here. First of all, when we talk about the lawfare that was used against Jorge Glass and at one point Rafael Correa as well, and the U.S. conservative, I guess, elements that role in this. Can you elaborate a bit on that? Because that was going on across Latin America in various ways with these like sort of lawfare projects to unseat or to just get rid of progressive and left-leaning politicians and candidates. But moreover, now with the Biden administration in charge, what has been the U.S. response to this so far? So like at this point, all I've seen is a few lukewarm statements that don't even really clarify, you know, who's in the wrong and who's in the right. Just a general like Anthony Blinken statement of like everybody should respect international law, but nothing more than that. So I'm curious, you know, is there any sort of U.S. hand here, whether it's the Biden administration or still those conservative elements in the U.S. that are backing the right in Ecuador? And can you, I guess, yeah, elaborate more on what happened in the past and why that's still so relevant when we're talking about this now?
So many Latin American progressive governments and the former officials of those progressive governments have been basically harassed by biased judicial systems, but with a key step prior to the judicial sentencing, which is that corporate media in these countries are becoming the judges of society, right? They frame the entire discussion with news headlines and with very powerful TV shows and with very strong media attacks in alliance with the government and intelligence agencies. And then with all the pressure and the media pressure, the courts decide, right, quote unquote. But this has been happening to Lula. This has been happening to Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina. This happened to Rafael Correa in Ecuador. When I ran for president, Correa was my vice presidential candidate. And, you know, the day before that, his candidate registration was in the Electoral Commission. He was sentenced in the fastest appeal at the Supreme Court in the history of the world. It only took 17 days for them to, you know, read, process, and write, you know, several thousand pages. And so, of course, that was just political persecution. And this has been ongoing against the major leaders of the progressive forces in Ecuador. Now, there's definitely a U.S. hand in this. We've seen documents from the Department of Justice and Department of State, where they say that they want to create these media platforms and the fake civil society organizations and media alliances to go after quote-unquote corrupt officials. But that is just the excuse to go after progressive officials and progressive governments in the region. Famously, in Ecuador, we have Diana Salazar, who was appointed there while Trump was the president, and she actually got an award from the Trump administration as an anti-corruption champion. And now there are important revelations certified by a Miami electronic forensics company that shows that she has been talking to the embassy of the United States throughout her tenure, and that the judicial measures have been, in fact, purposely designed to affect negatively the progressive forces of the Citizens' Revolution in Ecuador. So this is just starting. These revelations are just starting to come out, and it will be very important for the U.S. and Ecuador bilateral relationship. Now, more recently, with regards to the Jorge Glass case, the day after the raid, or 2 days after the raid, the Ecuadorian foreign minister called all the diplomatic ambassadors to go to the foreign ministry, and only one of them spoke. It was the U.S. ambassador. The rest of the ambassadors didn't even want to meet her because of the rejection of the, you know, the violation of the embassy plans.
You know, one of the things I think is important here is you know, I know the, you know, current president in Ecuador is a banana plantation owner. And you look at the past several presidents that have had such a sort of seems like a strong effort to persecute the leaders of the Citizens' Revolution. You know, what is it that they're so afraid of? Why is it that this movement, this Citizens' Revolution movement, is something that seems to be so odious to the right wing and many of the rich of Ecuador?
Well, the progressive movement in Ecuador, the Citizens' Revolution, was the one that transformed the Ecuadorian society. You know, with 10 years of governing, we changed our energy dependency. We diversified economic relations, specifically with the People's Republic of China. It allowed us to invest huge amounts of money in infrastructure. We tripled the tax revenues. We nationalized oil. We restructured and defaulted on our foreign debt. And so all these things, including granting asylum to Julian Assange and granting safe passage to Edward Snowden and kicking out a U.S. military base in Manta, well, as you can imagine, won't go unpunished. So these are the geopolitical repercussions that our leaders are suffering, that we've been suffering as well. In the case of my election, I was persecuted by the Colombian prosecutor general, who actually came to Ecuador and said that I had supposedly drug money funded into my campaign. Of course, that ended up being just BS. But here we are again, another chapter of political persecution.
You know, I'm also curious the importance of the Mexico angle here. I mean, this is not a small country. Mexico is a massive country. To have essentially invaded the Mexican embassy is just so insane. The fact that it like drew Mexico in this way, and now you have Mexico going to the International Court of Justice with a case against Ecuador. How important is the, I guess, inclusion of Mexico in this like horrific drama with Ecuador's lawfare, because it brings in one of the, you know, this massive country with like 120 million people, has a huge economy, is very, very important, and is now going to the ICJ.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely important in attracting attention to the political persecution that we've been denouncing over the years, and that, you know, few spaces have allowed us to speak to the world. But yeah, definitely gives a little bit more attention to what's been happening in Ecuador. When we organized a press conference with Jorge Glass lawyers, we were able to show to the world, you know, that this is just the final chapter, the last chapter in what has been 7 or 8 years of political persecution, where, you know, the judges are changed every time that they want to sentence somebody that they don't like, usually a Correista, usually someone from the Citizens Revolution. So it definitely gets the attention. And Mexico has had a tradition of political asylum. You know, they welcome political refugees on the left, on the right, and so on. And in this case, it's an attack on the Mexican policy of granting political asylum, mainly in the Americas, but also crucially in the Spanish Civil War, when many Spaniards entered Mexico and created, you know, many universities and colleges and so on. So this is definitely an important aspect of that. We feel supported by the Mexican people that have been very welcoming of political asylees and so on. And now we hope that this attention can help to restore the workings of our political and judicial system so that we can have peace, so that Jorge Glass can be free, so that he can go safely to Mexico, and so that the people, the politicians, the people that are giving the struggle here in Ecuador from a progressive perspective can, fight the fight without fearing that we're going to get imprisoned or killed, as has been happening over the last few years.
That was Andrés Arauz, former Ecuadorian presidential candidate and a research fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, speaking on Breakthrough News. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Eric Slater is a bus driver and executive board member of the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 241 in Chicago. He was running for president of the local when management had him arrested for criminal trespassing. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke to Slater, as well as his co-worker Robert Thomas and his lawyer Brad Thompson, about the collusion between union and management to thwart workers' democracy.
Eric, why don't you talk about this long struggle you've been battling for how long in Chicago in transit to better the conditions of workers and the people who use the service? And it seems you've faced firing yourself twice for taking up a fight to make things better for the workers and the users of the system.
Yeah, well, it's been going on for generations. There's some fighters back in the 60s that are still around, that they were facing some of the same things. You know, it's a real war at the workplace between management and rank and file workers, transit workers. For this, we have the second largest system in the United States, behind New York. And we have, over 2,000 bus operators, many hundreds of mechanics, office workers that do this work. That's just in our local union, Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 241. But this has been going on for some time. Basically, the city cannot or will not tolerate a powerful union, will not tolerate an independent voice of transit workers. And so when, you know, some honest shop stewards start develop and get a base, or they try to cut us down. So I was elected, it's been about 10 years ago. My coworkers asked me to run for executive board, which is basically a shop steward position. And almost immediately there was a war against the position because I wouldn't play the management rules. I was only for my coworkers, not for trying to be some kind of intermediary between the bosses and my employer. And then they fired me illegally in 2016. We won that through an international campaign. And thank you for some of your efforts too, Steve, getting the word out. We went all over the world. And then again, they fired me in 2020. While I was an executive board member, because I was an executive board member after George Floyd was murdered. And we simply held a meeting on property, as we've done hundreds of times. That meeting was disrupted by management illegally. And then they fired me on the spot. All we did was ask workers if they felt safe driving police shuttles. They were using the public transit system to shuttle police and National Guard to the protests against police brutality. And many workers were not okay with that. So we're discussing our position, trying to make a union position. That's when they fired me. So fast forward here, and I hope Brad and Robert can talk about, we just had another fight where we decided to run a campaign, a political campaign, to try to show another way forward in the union. And I ran for president. And during the campaign, CTA management called the police many dozens of times to have me, try to have me removed under the guise that I was a fired worker because they had illegally fired me. So they called the Chicago police to remove me. And they finally actually arrested me the day before the election. And they thoroughly put their hand on the election. So they arrested me, charged me with trespass, and then we had this trial.
And Robert Thomas, who's a CTA worker, and he's running for the executive board, and he's been fighting around conditions for drivers in the CTA. Robert, maybe you can talk about where the CTA, where the ATU rather, was in the local and nationally, because I know that there was an appeal to the ATU International to take this case up. You know, it seems like when a worker, a representative is targeted by the police, that's something that a union should say, we're not going to stand for that. We're going to fight that because it could affect the entire membership and the entire union. Can you talk about that, Robert, and what you see as a problem as far as the union backing up the members who stand up for the membership?
Well, our union, unfortunately, is infiltrated and controlled by CTA. Our employer, CTA, owns our union, and it should be that way. So they collaborate, management and union collaborate to get members fired, to get members disciplined. You know, they're working against me right now. Management is working with the union to prevent me from going to my own union meeting right now. That's what I'm dealing with.
How are they doing that? How do they do that?
Well, basically, the union president calls up his buddy, which is the manager over my garage, and say, hey, I don't like the fact that Robert's coming to every meeting every month. Try to block him. Don't let him trade his off days. Don't let him take a vacation day. Make sure he's at work on the union meeting day. We don't want him here. He asks too many questions. And it's horrible when the union is collaborating with the employer. And it's only 2 members out of 3,000 members that come to the union meeting. And that says a lot about how the members discuss and low morale they have for our union officials. They want change. They really do. Eric Slater got a lot of votes. And that was even with the CTA suppressing him from coming to the different locations to campaign, calling, getting them arrested, and all the other crazy stuff that they're doing. So we definitely need reform in ATU 241. They're being investigated right now by the U.S. Department of Labor because of some of the financial issues that they have with mission checks and other financial issues. So we don't know what's going to happen with our local, but we hope that we can get reform and we can get change soon.
So joining us on the show to talk about that is Brad Thompson, who's a attorney in Chicago with the People's Law Office. Brad, do you think that there was a conspiracy between the management and the union officials? I mean, it sounds like from what Robert is saying, this is continuing, that management is colluding with the union together to prevent members from even attending union meetings.
Yeah, you know, we were trying to get as much information as we could about that in terms of the forces behind this that were really driving calling the police there. You know, what the state produced to us in the criminal case did not reveal very much information. But from what I understand, based on what I did see and based on conversations with Robert and Eric and other workers, that is the case here. You know, that this is certainly CTA was pushing for this prosecution. And that became clear based on my interactions with the prosecutor that CTA wanted to see Eric prosecuted and didn't want to let that up in any way. And based on what the information that we have is that union management, you know, that it was a union management collaboration there, you know, that it was the people that were CTA's preferred candidates. And the exact reason that Eric was campaigning was being critical of that sort of close collaboration between the union and the bosses, and to really have some true workplace democracy there. And, you know, obviously Eric and Robert can talk to that with much more experience and more information than me about the depth of how deep that goes. But through the prosecution of Eric, it was clear that this was something that the management was pushing with the collaboration or backing of elements within the union.
What were some of the issues that brought you into activation to look to the union to deal with in your job and the job of other workers?
Well, I would say safety is a top priority right now. COVID didn't start it, but it definitely sped it up. Where we got angry customers, we got buses missing off the street, we got less drivers, we still got over 300 drivers short. They hired 1,000 workers, supposedly. So they're starting to bring back service to pre-pandemic levels. But we're still dealing with the stress of angry customers. They have put improved shields in, but the working conditions haven't gotten better, and they're still treating us like crap. And that's the main thing. If you want to keep your workers, then you have to treat the workers that you do have good. You have to appreciate them. You know, we just celebrated Transit Appreciation Worker Day on March 18th. And, you know, with one day a year, you would think that your employer will really show up and show out for that day. It was lackluster. They gave us donuts and coffee. That was it. So, you know, most of my workers have low morale because of these issues. When you know, you first come to work at 4 a.m., the first thing they want to do is discipline you, you know, when you first check in. Who wants to deal with that? No bathrooms at the end of the line. You got a porta potty. Female wants to use a porta potty and it's 2 degrees outside. You got to use the bathroom on a block of ice with a broken lock, with no hot water, with no security. I mean, come on. In 75 years, they can't figure out how to build a damn bathroom, a brick and mortar bathroom with running hot water, with heat, with lights, with security cameras. They just celebrated a 75-year anniversary last year, and they still can't figure out how to build a bathroom. I don't get it. You know, they passed a $2 billion budget at the beginning of the year. Seems like they got the money to build the bathroom, but they just don't have the will to do it. And the union is not saying nothing about it because they're laying in the bed with the CTA, so they don't care. Whatever favors they can get, they're happy with. So, you know, they say the answer to the bathroom issue is you can take a personal along the route. You can stop your bus along any route and you can go in a McDonald's or a Family Dollar or any business and use the bathroom. But that's not ideal in most situations, because when you come back, the customer's going to be mad, ready to beat your ass.
That was Chicago ATU fired bus driver Eric Slater, his co-worker Robert Thomas, and lawyer Brad Thompson speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Akua Holt, and Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.